So now we begin to live worshipful lives, not just having worship moments.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Kalia Williams. She's the Associate Dean of Worship and Music and Associate Professor in the Practice of Worship at the Candler School of Theology at Emory University. There, she's also co-director of the Baptist Studies Program. This is an interesting conversation, thinking particularly about worship in ways that I think will challenge and inspire us in our own church context. So here's my conversation with Kalia Williams of Emory University. Well, Kalia, first of all, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you here to talk particularly about worship, because that's something that you think a lot about as Associate Dean of Worship and Music, Associate Professor in the Practice of Worship. So, you know, maybe we should start there. Like, what does it mean that you are teaching worship?
Yes.
Isn't it something we do, right? You're teaching.
It is. I know everyone, there are many times when people are like, what do you actually teach? So I think there are a couple things that I do over here at Candler School of Theology. So the first one is the Associate Dean of Worship role, which allows me the opportunity to pretty much just have my finger on the pulse of the community and then oversee all of our worship and ceremonial life. And that's really exciting to me because it's right in my wheelhouse and what I love and allows all the creativity to flow. The beautiful part of it is I have a team of students every year, anywhere between 18 and 20 students who are really the ones that are responsible for all of the nuts and bolts of worship planning, putting together services and executing those services. And so they do everything from planning the flow, recruiting volunteers, picking the music, writing liturgy, all of that. And so a big part of what my role is really guiding those students. And I think that's teaching all the time. In addition to that, I do teach courses in worship, primarily that focus in on embodiment and worship, looking at womanist and feminist spirituality and worship and how we can examine the way lived experience connects with our ritual life, our worship life, and informs how we worship, and also how we worship informs the way in which we go out and live life. So to do that, though, does require like some getting down to just teaching basics. And I think I believe everyone needs a crash course, at least one, on what does it mean to do worship? What does that look like? You know, we are doing something, but the something that we do actually gets structured and put together and planned by someone. And so how do we faithfully engage in not only the planning and preparation, but even in the doing of worship? And that would be the central focus of how I teach and how I navigate, even in my role of overseeing the worship life.
Yeah, you mentioned that idea of having a crash course in worship. And actually, one of the things I was going to ask you was, so let's start there, is this idea of maybe one, you know, two, if you really got a couple things you can't narrow it down to, but what would be, obviously your crash course would have a lot more things. But if there was one kind of understanding about worship that you wish the average layperson would understand about Christian worship, liturgy, you know, what's that kind of preview teaser that you want to give right now to get people to sign up for this, you know, class? You can start it next semester online, right? We'll start the registration
exactly.
Right now.
So yes.
What is it that you wish people understood?
I'm going to give you two things that I really wish people understood. Number one, the foundational part is that worship is something that God invites us into, and it is a divine act. And so God invites us to, in public worship, come together as a community to lift up our praise unto God. That is the invitation. We are called in to do this thing called worship. Now, the second crash course point that I would offer is in that calling to do something divine, it will break. And I tell people all the time when I'm working with worship planning teams and worship leaders, worship will break. Why? Because we are human individuals. We are humanity trying to do something divine, and our humanity is limited. And so in everything that we do and all of the preparation, sometimes it does break. And what we should do is not seek out perfection, but look at how God is actually doing something new in the breaking. That's where we see something divine actually happening there as well. So we're called to do this thing that's divine, and it is just this wonderful grace and calling to enter into worship. And in our limitations as fallible human beings, we will sometimes not get it right. And that's okay, because God is still doing something, even when what we think we were supposed to be doing tends to break.
You also mentioned these concepts that you teach, you know, such as embodiment and kind of how worship interacts with our lived experiences. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk about that, because I think sometimes we, you know, we have this sense of like, well, maybe it's Sunday morning, I, you know, go into the sanctuary, and then we have that time of worship.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can, you know, help us think about, you know, why is worship so much more than just, you know, the music that we sing on a Sunday morning?
Absolutely. So I start the point of embodiment in worship with the reality that we all, we are all bodies coming into this space, and our bodies carry experiences and memory, and that enters into worship with us. So it's not just about the music that we picked, but it's about understanding and being sensitive to what we bring into the space with us, because we don't check those experiences at the door. While some of us might think we turn all of that off to come into this thing called worship, that's the sacred part of this invitation that I believe that we are given and gifted from God to bring our whole selves into the worship moment. So if we're bringing our whole selves, that means all that we've experienced, our lived experiences, are coming with us in there. Now, if you have a room of 50 people worshiping, you have 50 different experiences coming into this space. And then we are called to have a full awareness of what that is that we bring into the space, a full awareness of how our bodies are reacting in the space and the bodies around us. And when we have that type of awareness, we really do lean into the worship moments differently. And we have a bit more of an expansive experience in those moments, recognizing that what's happening right there isn't just isolated to that one time that we're together, but it really is informed by what we brought in, and it's informing and shaping what we take out, right? And how we're going to leave out of the space. So now we begin to live worshipful lives, not just having worship moments.
Yeah, you're talking about this idea of, you know, if you got 50 people in the sanctuary and there's 50 different lived experiences, and at the same time, there are also moments where, you know, we probably know that all, if there are at least most people experienced in some way, you know, in the previous week. I'm thinking about this because this will come out in a couple of weeks, but as we're talking, it's just a couple of days after the school shooting in Texas. And I'm assuming that, you know, there's going to be a lot of people in our churches this Sunday across the country that will be carrying that moment with yep. them as they walk into the sanctuary. And so how do we think about worship after, you know, whether it's a tragedy, we can maybe focus on that in a time like this, when we know that people are carrying this burden, we know this is, I mean, you're gonna have parents and grandparents who are, you know, thinking about, you know, what if that was here? Mm-hmm. How do we make it so that worship isn't an escape from the problems that we're facing?
Brian, thank you for asking that. I feel like you're teeing
like
me
set you up
for all. Yes, you did. That is like wonderful. So I have a lot of conversations around honest worship. And what does honest worship mean? What does honest worship look like? What does it mean to really, you know, I know we oftentimes overuse the term authentic, so I like to stay away from it sometimes because it is overused, but it's a real thing, right? What does it mean to worship authentically? And in situations like we're in right now, as we are recording this, like the first thing I like to share is, first and foremost, we have to really and truly just name what's in the room. And don't be afraid to use the worship time to name what's in this space. And so this coming Sunday, my expectation or my hope would be that churches all over the place would take some time to name the sadness, the lament, the fear that is entering into the space with our congregants. And we need to name that in order to humanize the moment, because worship in and of itself is relevant and it is in the moment. And so it's not detached from the realities of our lived experiences. In fact, God is inviting us to bring it here, right? Bring all of that into this space. So go ahead and name it and lift it. And what becomes so amazing in the opportunities when we do this with worship is we begin to name and lift this in community, which means then we don't isolate our feelings, but we witness together the feelings of one another that allows us to come into connection even more deeply. And we hold each other in our hearts, in our prayers, in our actions, in our lived experiences. And we then truly become a community, not one that just kind of shows up in facades on Sunday. Everything's great. We worship together and then we disperse and go our separate ways. But one that actually comes, gathers the cares of the community and holds those cares together from one Sunday to another. But we can only do that when we're honest and when we're naming what we bring into the space. And so I love those moments where I can push congregations to actually have a time and a moment of naming, right? For some church traditions, it's testimony. It's share your praises and share your concerns and share your lament. For others, it is actually just kind of holding space and prayers of the people where we're able to audibly voice what we're feeling and what we're carrying. And I think that's just so important to really be able to get to the heart of a community. Like, who are we together? As a community, who are we called to be together as a community, and how do we hold one another in this space as a community?
You mentioned a couple of times the word lament, which, you know, is something that we see obviously a lot in the Psalms and in other parts of the scripture, but, you know, I've seen studies about our hymnals that many of them have very few laments, you know, comparatively. And I mean, and you're like, you know this, and then, you know, contemporary, you know, praise worship that's often in churches is probably even, you know, more towards the like hyper happy and upbeat, you know, tunes. And so, you know, what are we missing in our worship when we don't have a practice of lament in our worship?
So we're missing the opportunity to actually just honestly bring our cares before God, our communal and our individual cares before God in those worship spaces. And we start to literally socialize individuals to think that that's not appropriate in worship. Think about that, right? Subconsciously, if we sing our faith, I love that, right? One of my colleagues here, a director of chapel music who works with me closely, like he teaches our students all the time how what we sing, we are literally singing our faith. We are proclaiming our faith. The songs are literally carrying our faith. And so if that is true, and we fail to create spaces of lament, whether it's in song, whether it's in prayer, in our worship spaces, we are subconsciously socializing congregations to feel like we cannot bring concerns and cares and laments and struggles and strife and fear and anger and all of that to God in this public space. That's what we're socializing our congregations to believe. Whether we are explicit in saying that or not, essentially that's what our practices, that's how our rituals are shaping us. So we then are saying, leave this in your private life and private space. And sometimes that even pours into, hey, we can't even bring this to God, right? And so I think there has to be this opportunity that allows us to model in community what it looks like to bring all the heavy stuff to God in this community. And then what it looks like to care for one another in the midst of that. If we model it in worship, we are training ourselves to do that in our day-to-day living. If we do it in our day-to-day living, we are then informing the opportunity to continue to do it in our worship space. It's this continuum that happens, right? So what we do in worship impacts how we live. How we live impacts how we what we do in worship. And if we are able to really allow lament to show up in those spaces, both private and public spaces, then I think we allow the fullness of who we are. We allow ourselves to tap into the fullness of who we are. And then there's a seeing ourselves as whole individuals before God, a God who created us, right? In God's image, we're able to see the fruit of that and not think that that always just looks good and nice. And it's only when things are going well for us and all the successes for us. But no, it's also to say, well, God who created us is also with us in our down moments, in our struggles, in our suffering. And that God invites us to bring that lament forward. I mean, the entire psalm, I mean, if you sit through the book of Psalms, right, how much lament is there, and just how much just real opening ourselves up before God and just being honest. And I also think when we create the spaces of lament, it allows us to expand the way we understand and imagine God. So in our worship, we are creating an image. We are literally kind of proclaiming how we imagine God. And sometimes I think it might be limited. And so spaces of lament allow us to witness and understand God in a much more expansive way, as a God who can carry and handle and hold all of our struggles, but a God who's also with us in that struggle. And so what does that mean then, when we are days removed from a heinous act of gun violence upon an elementary school, and we can say, God, this makes me sad. God, this makes me angry. God, this makes me afraid if I am a parent rearing young children. And then to know that God is right there with us, even in those fields. That gives us a different view of God, who literally sits close with us in everything that we feel. I think creating those spaces of lament can do all of that for us and for our communities.
Yeah, and I've been thinking about that. I mean, not just have we had this the school shooting, we've had the shooting in Buffalo, New York, at a church in California.
That's right.
Yep. The last couple of years, we've had, you know, a number of protests and movements on racial justice, which has been, you know, crying out in the streets about, you know, things. And then we've also had COVID. We just passed the million mark in the United States of people who have died from COVID. I mean, it seems like if we can't lament now, our worship doesn't seem to really, I mean, I've seen too many churches where it feels like we're just singing the same old songs.
That's
even
right.
Even in this time.
That's right. Yeah, we have to, right? And I think there's a part of the lament that allows us to kind of just tell the truth. And I think that's the big piece, right? Our lament just lets us tell the truth. And then in our telling the truth of where we are, we begin to see the truth of who God is and how God is active. And that's what all of this brings about, you know, the big question, right? COVID hits and we think, oh, maybe it's just a couple of weeks, and now it becomes a few years. And my goodness, we're not post-pandemic, as many are saying. I think we're just, you know, becoming more and more pandemic tolerant. But it allows us to be able to witness who God is, even in these difficult moments, and how God is active really in our life. And when we are able to kind of lean into that revelation, it helps us to really begin to think about what then is our outward expression of our faith with a God who is active in these moments. How are we telling the truth about not only what we're feeling, but how do we tell the truth about God and who God is in this moment that doesn't always feel good, that doesn't always kind of help assuage the struggle and the difficult feelings that we have, but really does kind of motivate us to witness God in new ways that I think then motivates us to be active in our lives, in our faith, in different ways.
And of course, you know, thinking about COVID, I mean, obviously it disrupted so many aspects of life and church life, but worship is one of those areas where, we had periods where we were being, encouraged not to gather publicly, not to meet. Mm-hmm. And if we do gather, mask, don't sing, right? The preaching, I feel like the preachers, right? They could still, stand in front of a camera and do their thing, right? And that's talk, right. And, we could all watch it online, but the worship element, that doesn't yep. translate as well. What have we learned about worship? Or what do you hope that we are learning about worship from COVID?
So I hope that we're learning that worship is much bigger than what we've been doing in routine. And every now and then routine gets disrupted in really, really major ways and forces us to imagine how we then engage and connect differently, right? And so that's the breaking piece that I talked about earlier, where worship breaks. Well, guess what? Everyone's concept of worship broke in 2020. And so we had to figure out, how do we do this differently? And there were so many theological debates on, do we do virtual communion or don't we? Or do we, what's really worship and what isn't? I just recently read an article that says, you can have worship online, but it's not really a worship service. And there's this kind of debate even there. And so it's this idea of, I think what it does is it forces us to just step back and one, think about, what are the things that we've imposed on worship? We, humanity, what have we imposed on this act of worship that maybe God never even set out for us to just kind of be so tied to and stuck to? And then get down to the basics, drilling down to the foundation and the basics. If worship is this gift that God invites us into, and we experience the graces of God in these worship moments, then what are those graces and how is God inviting us to experience them anew? Getting us down to that, just down to the basics. And I hope, I really, really do hope that after almost 2.5 years of figuring out and navigating worship in different ways, from being completely remote to hybrid to back to remote for some communities, to figuring all of this out, my hope and my prayer is that that none of us return to business as usual as it relates to worship, and none of us kind of say, well, let's rush back to what we used to do, but we really, as communities, right, just take some time and witness to what God did do for us in the midst of this pandemic, and how God was able to sustain, and how God brought community closer in these different ways of worshiping, and then let that inform how we move forward. And I stress that we do that in community, because I think it's really easy for one leader or a small set of leaders to make some determinations about where we go. But I think it's necessary to hear how congregations were impacted as a whole, because there's some things that congregations will say, oh, we're not going back to that. Where the leaders might feel like, oh, we're definitely going to go back to this because this was something that was really vibrant. And the congregants might have found something new in their own way of discovering God and worshiping God and leaning into the graces of God that really they would want to carry forward. So I think it has to be some communal conversation that happens in order for us to imagine where we go in our worship experiences.
So as pastors and staff, lay leaders are listening, what's the thing you want them to drop? What's the thing we should not? I'm trying to get you in trouble here. What's the thing
you are trying to get me in trouble?
Cut and never go back to post COVID.
So I don't have a thing, because every worship community is very different, but I have a concept. Maybe I'll say that, right? I think we should imagine what's the most isolating part of our worship experiences. What were the most isolating part of our worship experiences? Stop doing those. Yeah. How do we not isolate members of our community? How do we not push members of our community further to the margins? And so if there were things that we were doing that might have pushed folks to the margins, maybe ways that we were saying things, maybe language that we were using, stop that. Whatever that thing is, don't do that again.
I also want to note that, I mean, you don't just teach this, you are also, you know, engaged obviously in local community. You're an associate minister at a Baptist church in Atlanta. Yep. So what is this 2 years, 2.5 years been like from the ministry side in, you know, trying to walk with people and help them to experience and find God during this time?
Yeah, it's been hard, right? I think that's the only way I can name it is it's been difficult because while we're journeying with members, we're journeying in it ourselves. And so there's this piece. It's been difficult, but it's been extremely humbling at the same time. And one of the things that I have found in all of it, as I reflect over the last 2 years within my own congregation, and I hold a little bit of a different posture and role. My husband pastors the congregation, so I serve as an associate minister, but also as the pastor's wife, right? So in our Baptist tradition, as the first lady of the church. And so that calls me into even closer relationship with our members and just to kind of journey even more closely and to hold our members in my heart, probably in just the deepest ways. And in this time, it's been deeper than ever before. And what I have found in it, in the humbling nature of it, has been one, just the reminder that we all wrestle with our humanity, A. And then B, there has been glimpses along the way of the beauty and connectionality, right? In connectional ministry. And this is where I kind of rested in the last year or so to imagine what does that really then mean for worship and just for ministry as a whole? When we think about a church that our church is a historic church. We've been around for 150 years. Most of our members are seniors in the church, right? So you talk about an average age of 60 plus. And then within a week, we are switching everyone to virtual worship. Well, that then requires getting on the phone and helping your seniors learn how to actually log into the virtual worship platform, and requires making a lot of pivots. And our pastor, my husband, I've watched him just do it remarkably, where it was taking the time, literally, if it was sending someone over or him having to show up at someone's house and literally walk them through how to get connected on a Sunday, it happened. And I think as a result of that, a lot of folks felt like they still were connected. And it was transforming our Wednesday evening Bible study while we meet on Zoom. It was transforming it to have an hour or 30 minutes of just conversation and fellowship time, because everyone's isolated in their homes and you can't see people or you're not talking to individuals. And so having this connectional aspect, this relational deepening across the pandemic, that's been the journey. That's been the emphasis and the focus. And so I carry that into thinking about worship to say, well, how does worship become relational? And that's why I have my one, like, what's the one thing I'd want everyone to stop doing is, you know, stop doing the things that push people away and start doing the things that are more relational and draw us into connection with one another, whatever that looks like. And that very well might transform an entire order of worship. And that's okay, right? That's okay if from beginning to end of a service, it looks drastically different because we need to do things differently in order to make sure that we are drawing folks in and being more relational and more connectional in our approach.
So, you know, one of the other things you mentioned early on in our conversation that you teach is you talk about worship from a womanist perspective. And I wanted to come back to that because, you know, I suspect some people might be wondering, wait, what does that mean? Like, you know, worship is worship. And so What do you mean when you're trying to help us to understand worship from different perspectives? You know, particularly someone, I'll name it, I'm a white man, right? So what can I learn from another way of thinking about worship?
Absolutely. Okay. So first and foremost, when I teach worship from a womanist or feminist perspective, the idea is I am teaching worship from a perspective that is focused on particularity, right? That's really what it is. And I won't go into the lesson of what is womanism, what is feminism. I personally write and do everything that I do out of a womanist perspective, because that perspective does focus in on African-American women's lived experiences. That's the experience that I focus in on. All of my research has really kind of grown out of that space. But the overall emphasis and why I teach these courses is to focus in on particularity, to focus in on the understanding that we all have particular lived experiences that enter into worship with us. And within history, or throughout history, we have to deal with systemic oppression, systemic racism, systemic, you know, sexism, like, right, we have a litany of ways that we can look at and think about how individuals have been oppressed. And I, being born here in the United States, my particularity, my focus when we talk about systemic oppression and injustices focuses in on kind of what has happened here in the U.S., right? And so I think through how our country kind of has this legacy of oppression. And so that then resides in the heritage of all of us, of every individual. We are shaped through the legacy of our country's systemic oppression. So now, what does that mean for worship, right? You take that really, really big concept and you draw it into, what does that mean for worship? It means then that if we've dealt with injustice in our larger context of life, guess what? Injustice shows up even in the narrowed focus of our worship. And so it's starting to identify the spaces and the ways in which we recognize systemic oppression showing up in worship. I do it from perspectives of women because that's one particularity. We could take it and do it from the particularity of children. We could take it and do it from the particularity of differently abled bodies and spaces, right? And so those who enter our spaces with certain disabilities, we could take it and relate it to those who are older. So looking at age, right? And so it's this idea when I teach it to say, let's start looking at how we witness and recognize the way injustice kind of shows up in worship. And so what do we do about that? And so what do we have to change about our worship experiences? And I'm teaching seminarians, so I'm teaching future worship leaders of some sort. Not all of them are going into congregational context, but I tell them all, you go through seminary, you come out with a theology degree, people are going to expect you to either be able to pray at the drop of a dime or be able to lead or shape some kind of centering moment or worship service. Doesn't matter where you go to work after this, that's just going to be a common expectation. So let's figure out then how we shape these moments in a more just way. And so that's the piece that really we think about. And a lot of folks get uncomfortable, I will tell you, outside of kind of the theological education space, although some people get really uncomfortable in this space as well. But I think a lot of people get uncomfortable when we start to really think, oh, our worship can be racist. Our worship can be sexist. Our worship can be ageist. Our worship can, right? Like there's this discomfort that says, no, that's not the case. Worship is the happy place. Worship is where everyone has a chance to come in. And so there are little things that I start to, or I won't say little things, or big things that I like to teach, which is to say, let's do a run of what we sing. And how often in what we sing are we utilizing masculine language to speak of all humanity? Let's think about what we preach. And over the course of 52 weeks, how many times did we preach from the perspective of women in Scripture, or from the perspective of children in Scripture? Or how often did we preach from the perspective of men in scripture. How often do we relate to God and name God in very limited ways, like gender-based naming of God? God is Father. God is He. And I even push students beyond wanting to say, well, in order to be equitable, how about God be mother and God be she? Well, that's great, but that's placing God into the finite box of gender binaries. God's much more expansive than that. And so it's pushing them to be able to imagine God in different ways. So we deal with language. We deal with how we utilize space. And so thinking of bodies in space and what bodies have authority in space and have preference in space. And that's something that we don't necessarily even think through, right? But if you enter in and all of the leaders of the community sit on the first two rows and all of our leaders are of one gender, well, we've just named authority and power in that space, right? And so it's thinking about how all of this comes together in worship and it shapes our concept of who God is in that space, in that time, in the act of worship. And so it pushes us to then begin to think of, imagine, and actually practice more ways that are just and that deconstruct some of these systems of oppression.
Yeah, I love what you're doing is trying to help us to think about all of the different things that we might be communicating.
Yep.
So it's, I mean, obviously the words matter, and you know, a lot of our older hymns particularly have the masculine exclusive language, but then there's so much more. It is the building, it is the seating arrangement, there's so much more that impacts, and it doesn't just impact how people feel, but it communicates to them something about God and about their place before mm-hmm. God and in the church. And I don't know, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about that, because what might we be able to think about more carefully in our physical space? You were just talking a little bit about it, but you know, in our sanctuaries or wherever we're gathering for worship, you know, can you help us to think more about the impact that has on the worship experience and in helping people or hurting people from getting to experience God and to know God?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I think the first one that's you know, the most obvious for me that jumps out immediately is when we think about our space, is our space accessible? And that's one piece. And I think, you know, we're far enough along in this idea of accessibility that we put some thought into can different people maneuver the space? And if we have, you know, I think the big piece is, well, what if someone is in a wheelchair? Can they enter into the space? And what does that feel like? Or, you know, do we have that kind of space created? And do we have the ramps and that accessibility? But I think I like us to think about accessibility even more broadly. And I've worked with amazing students here at Candler who've helped me even begin to think deeply about accessibility beyond just kind of the physical accessibility, but what about individuals who come in with maybe some neurological disabilities and what needs to happen in the space to even accommodate, right? That and what about lighting? How does lighting impact individuals? So I think thinking along those lines becomes very helpful. The other piece is how do we utilize the space? So one, accessibility, and then two, utilization. How do we utilize the space? Is it all fixed or are we able to transition space in different ways? Because if we're all fixed and it's literally the kind of old school traditional, and I say this, my congregation is set up this way too. So like no shade to anyone out there whose congregation is set this way, but it's like the pews that are like drilled in and
bolted,
you know,
to the floor. Do not steal this pew.
Floor. And then it's all one directional toward the pulpit that's elevated, that says something, right? And so that then says, well, for a member who just kind of coming in, I only have access to one side. I can't venture over into this space that's quote unquote sacred, right? We make this stark divide in our setup. And so that, how is that functioning? How are we utilizing that? Or do we have flex space where we can create a more circular egalitarian kind of feel in this space? And then who sits where? How are we utilizing that? How are we utilizing the space of just designating who sits where? What pews get reserved? What seats are reserved all of the time? And who are they reserved for? And what are we saying by, you know, stating, well, only those who are ordained can sit in these spaces? There's a divide that's happening there. And so we're actually using this space then to create some division. I love spaces where it's like, no, let me sit in the middle. Like, I want to be around everyone. Even if I am the preacher for the day, I want to get into the mix, because there's so much more that you glean from kind of just being in the mix and among the full congregation. And so thinking of how you're utilizing space, so accessibility and then utilization, and just being very clear, asking the questions that I don't think we ask, which is, what is our space saying? What is the way that we use this space? What is it actually saying about us as a congregation? But what is our space communicating about God? Is God a God who divides? Because if, like, that's what we're saying here. God is deemed one section of this entire building as sacred. I remember growing up and it was like, no, you can't go into the pulpit, or no, you can't touch the communion table, right? Because that's sacred. And so it's saying, well, God is deeming this section only as sacred, and you're not allowed to enter the space that is sacred. Is that what God is calling us to communicate about God, right, in this day? And so there are ways that we're able to kind of deconstruct that, even if your pews are bolted to the floor and you just can't take them up right now, that's okay. There are still ways to then utilize space. At this point, it's utilizing bodies in space to do something different, and to transform what we're messaging in the space. And so if that's the case, then if you have this pulpit that's deemed sacred and no one can come into it, well, what happens when you allow kids in the pulpit and to lead in worship? Well, now you've just demystified the space a bit. Or if you allow families to stand at the communion table and assist in communion, now you've just demystified this, and you're making it a much more inclusive space. So even if you can't just like do flip the whole structure as we all wish we could, there are ways to then use bodies and spaces to really change how we understand the function of space.
Yeah, I think that's some great thoughts. And of course, I think everyone should be allowed to sit wherever they want to, as long as it's not in my pew. But
yeah. Look at you, Brian. You know, I'm going to challenge you next time to sit somewhere else when you go in.
No, don't do that. Yes. That's not fair. We'll be right back with the rest of this conversation. But first, I want to remind you that you should subscribe to Warden Way's award-winning e-newsletter, A Public Witness. It will help you make sense of the world of faith, culture, and politics. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wardenway.org. And now, back to our conversation. One of the other debates that's been happening in, you know, our culture and in some churches is we've seen a number of scandals, you know, throughout the years, but particularly one of the more recent ones with Hillsong has been, sure, the scandals are about all these churches that are collapsing, but unlike a lot of mega churches, Hillsong shows up in a lot of other churches across the world even. And, you know, it's raised some debates. We've written about this, and I know you know this at our Substack newsletter, A Public Witness, about, you know, what does it mean to sing a song from Hillsong in, you know, thinking about what we were talking about earlier, right? People are bringing in their lived experiences. They've heard in the news about these scandals. Yep. And then we're asking them to sing, you know, What a Beautiful Name or something. And, you know, yep, like, what does that do? So how do we wrestle with, I don't know, some of these public scandals involving the music or the musicians?
Oh my goodness. So this is a continuous wrestle. And I don't think I have a final answer. I am in the midst of the wrestling myself. I think we as faithful and just worship leaders have a real responsibility to be aware of what's happening and to be very careful in what we allow to be communicated, not just what we sing, but what's tied to what we sing in the space, and then to be mindful of individuals who are in our congregations. And so oftentimes I think the way I think about it is, while the song is beautiful, and while the song might do something for individuals personally, as a public community coming together in worship, and as the one who's leading and making decisions about what we do in that community, what if someone is in the community who has also been a victim, right? And then we're singing this song and we say, oh, well, it's removed from the scandal that happened. But in their hearing it, they're triggered. I have a responsibility to care for the community, right? And so for that reason, my personal desire is to, you know, we don't lift up the songs. We don't sing the songs of Hillsong, or, you know, there are others, right? Not just singling, you know, like it's Hillsong and others that we wrestle with quite a bit. And I think here it's a regular wrestling, because we have students who love the music, and you know, the team that works with me will bring something up, and myself and my and the director of chapel music will have to kind of text each other like, okay, so how do you feel about this? But there's that piece of teaching even future worship leaders and ministry leaders how we have a really deep responsibility to care for the communities to which we are called. And sometimes that's going to mean that we have to say no to singing the songs that we might have loved once upon a time, because it really does carry an experience with it. And I have yet to figure out and find out, and Brian, if you figure it out, let me know, how do you disconnect experience and history from the music? I don't know that you can. One of the things, I am not a musician by any means, but I love music. I'm a dancer. And so I've grown up in dancing, classical ballet, and I've fallen in love with all types of music as a result of my own dance experience. And one of the things I've always loved, particularly in the classical ballet arena, when you're learning about the piece of music that you're dancing to, you learn about the musician, you learn about the composer, you learn about what's happening in that time. So there's a history that gets tied to it. And if that is indeed the case, then when we think about some of our contemporary music, there's a history and an experience that is tied to it from the individuals who've composed it, but also for those who are listening. And we have to be really mindful of that. It's sad, because that means there's a large list of music in our repertoire that just has to come out, you know, and it is sad, but it is the right thing to do. And I firmly believe that that's the direction that worship leaders and congregational leaders need to take, is understanding our responsibility to care for the communities to which we are called, and making the hard decisions to not continue to perpetuate some of the injustice and the violence and the harm that has been perpetuated upon others by lifting up those songs. And there's another, I mean, there's a whole other big piece of like royalties and licensing and money, and you know, that draws back to it, right? That like goes back where if you're going through CCLI, the number of times a song is reported, like there's money that's going back into these communities. Like, do you want to fund that? Do you want to be a part of, you know, tied to that support? No, we shouldn't.
Well, my one last question I had for you, I just wanted to note that you do wear one other hat that we haven't mentioned as co-director of the Baptist Studies program.
Yep.
And I mean, so here you are helping lead a Baptist Studies program at a Methodist seminary, and you just talked about being ecumenical. So you're practicing that. And
in addition
to being ordained as American Baptist Churches USA, you're also ordained in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. So, So what's going on with this program? I wonder if you give us a quick little introduction to that.
Absolutely. So it's a great program. The Baptist Studies program has been around for quite a while at Candler School of Theology. My husband and I have taken it over within the last couple of years. And so we co-direct it together. And we create community among our Baptist students. Baptists are the second largest denomination group of students here at Candler School of Theology. And so it's been our job to, one, ensure that there's just a community in place for Baptist students to go as they are matriculating through to ask questions that are related to like the Baptist experience. And that's great because they'll be doing like their, we do contextual education, which is our field education, and they'll go out and they'll do that in church settings their second year. And they may be in a Baptist church and they're like, wait, I need to talk to someone about what this whole structure of the church means. Like, what's the trustees and the deacons and how do they work? And, you know, just so creating that space. The other piece that we do, though, is we oversee the certificate program. And so students who want to really kind of deepen their own Baptist identity and knowledge as they prepare for ministry, they go through our certificate program, which gives them an opportunity to take classes in Baptist polity and theology, Baptist history. And we also offer a series of what we call professional development workshops. And so those workshops are everything from how do you negotiate a call, because we don't, because we're Baptist, we're, you know, there's not a placement process like the United Methodist denomination does, where if you are ordained, then you move into kind of this itinerancy and you get placed somewhere. There's no guarantee there in the Baptist church. And so we help our students begin to think about what does it mean to go into a search and call process when a church opens up a position for a call, and how do you even just submit an application, or what does it look like to be in conversation and negotiating salary and pension and all of that, because not every Baptist church is set up that way. And so realizing that we are a part of a disconnected denomination where there's autonomy throughout each individual church, there is certain things that our students should be thinking about and learning very early. And that really comes out of lived experience, right? So my husband and I met when we were in seminary, and then he gets called into his, right out of seminary, he gets called into the church that we're in now. And so there's so many questions there. And many of our colleagues who kind of get called into churches or who get go through this search and call process, and they get hired in, and they're just so many things they don't know. And so trying to equip students early on some of the basics, nuts and bolts of things that they don't know, to help them so they really can go in and do ministry freely without trying to figure out all this other stuff that, you know, figuring out what a benefits package should look like, you know, helping them learn that early. The other part is that we do a lot of partnering with the local Atlanta Baptist churches. So our students come in, and the ideal setup is that students will come in their first year, particularly for our Masters of Divinity students, in their first year, they will get connected with one of our local partner churches, and they will serve in that church. And as they move through, they'll serve in that church the whole time that they're here. And those partner churches have agreed that as they will mentor, they will train, they will invest in the students. And the goal is to move them into the space of licensing and ordination. Very, very different than the United Methodist context, where there's already a clear licensing and ordination track. There is not necessarily one within the Baptist church. So we're trying to create, or I will say we have created, because we've had some great success with some of our students who've committed to that process and have been able to be licensed and to be ordained into ministry and feel some sense of security and affirmation while they are here, even if they are moving back and going to a home church somewhere else or going into ministry in other places. While they are matriculating through Candler, they have a church where they're connected, but not only where they're connected and attending, a church that's really invested in them and invested in seeing them grow in their ministry.
Thank you so much for joining us on the program and helping us to think more seriously and carefully about worship. I really appreciate it. And this has been a great conversation.
Brian, thank you so much. This has been wonderful talking with you today.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.